Resources meeting to order. Today is February 25th, 2015, and we're going to receive a mining industry update. So welcome, everyone. I want to recognize Senate Resource Committee members. Senator Costello and Senator Stoltz are here. Senator Costello is vice chair of the committee. And my aide is Ike Geolopsis, sitting over here to the left. Representative Tallarico, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'd like to recognize Representative Josephson and the Vice Chair of the Resource Committee, Representative Hawker. And my committee aide is Julie Morris, right back there. And Rep. Nagiok's committee aide is Gary Zepp, right here. They do the committee aide work for us in the Resource Committee on the House side.
Great. Wonderful. So we're welcoming to the table today Deantha Crockett and Karen Mathias, who will go ahead and proceed to give us an update. I also want to apologize in advance. A few minutes before 1, I need to leave, so I'll be turning the gavel over to Representative Tallarico. So I apologize in advance. So, ladies, please, welcome.
Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Deantha Crockett. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. AMA is a trade association that represents the mineral industry in Alaska, from large-scale mines and projects to the placer mining membership to vendors and contractors and really anyone that does business with the mining industry.
And for the record, my name is Karen Mathias. I manage the Council of Alaska Producers, which is the trade association for large metal mines producing in Alaska, as well as some advanced projects. All of my members are members of AMA, and we work very closely together. I'd like to start our presentation with a safety moment. Safety is a core value for our industry. And as legislators, you often have the opportunity to do an industry visit. Maybe it's mining or another industry. And when you go, they give you personal protection, earplugs, and protective glasses, often a safety vest. You get a briefing and a tour guide. And at the end of your tour, you take them off and go back to your office or go home. So my message is about what happens when you leave the site and taking that safety with you, that emphasis on safety. I grew up, my dad worked in construction, did a lot of house repairs, and I don't honestly remember him ever wearing safety glasses. That was just kind of the culture in the 1970s. So fast forward, my husband is a doctor, but he does a lot of home projects as well. And he always wears safety glasses. And I noticed that because it's not the norm for me. And I realized, he works in an emergency room. He sees eye injuries that probably could have been prevented if people had been wearing safety glasses, but they rarely do. So he has them all over the house. The next time you do an industry tour, I encourage you, take those safety glasses home, put them somewhere handy, and use them, please, and protect your eyes. And now Deantha is going to give us an overview of our presentation.
So just an overview of the points we'd like to leave you with today. It's great to see some familiar faces, and there are some new people that we haven't had the pleasure of presenting to before. So I'm going to give a quick overview of the mining industry, tell you why we think mining passes the test in Alaska. We'll outline the economic realities that are facing the industry and highlight the great potential we see in the industry. And most importantly, we are going to allow ample time for questions from the committee members. So here you'll see a somewhat comical cartoon of a mere fraction of the products we depend on that come from mining. Some examples I'd like to give you is gold is anti-corrosive and is used to make sure that the airbags in your car deploy in the event of a crash. Silver is used in hospitals on patients with burns to prevent a skin infection and to treat the burn. Zinc is used to galvanize guardrails so that they hold your car up in a crash, and of course it's used to prevent sunburn. Copper tubes provide safe, potable water supply, and copper also acts as a reliable conduit for smoke detectors, and other emergency systems. Lead provides battery strength necessary for emergency backup power of computer server systems and telecommunications in the event of power failure. And the fun one I'll leave you with is platinum, silver, gold, copper, and aluminum, all of which are found in Alaska, are critical elements of your iPhone.
I'll just add, Deantha, zinc is also in diaper rash ointment. Very, very effective. As a grandma.
That's good to know. Thank you. So where does mining occur in Alaska? Virtually everywhere. Please note that the map that's found on your screen is in your handouts, in the brochure. It's the centerfold. You'll see where our six large operating mines, as well as our over a dozen exploration projects, are located. And I'm going to outline our operating mines for you. The first on the screen is the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska. It's one of the world's largest zinc mines, and they also produce lead and silver. Red Dog is on Nana Regional Corporation land and is operated by Teck. In that partnership, they're celebrating 25 years, so it's been running for over 25 years. The Red Dog Mine employs 600 employees, a large percentage of which are Alaska Native and Nana Corporation shareholders. And the Red Dog Mine is the only taxpayer in the form of the payment in lieu of taxes system in the Northwest Arctic Borough. Moving south to Fairbanks, the Fort Knox mine is Alaska's largest producing gold mine. It is on State of Alaska and Alaska Mental Health Trust land and is operated by Kinross Gold. Fort Knox employs 650 people, all of whom live in Fairbanks and drive to work and go home at the end of their shift. And Fort Knox is the largest property taxpayer in the Fairbanks North Star Borough. New Sibeli Coal Mine in Healy, adjacent to Denali National Park, has been operating continuously since 1943. They employ 140 people, many of whom live in Healy, where the mine pays the majority of the severance taxes for the Denali Borough. I feel silly saying this to Representative Tallarico. New Sibeli Coal fuels 30% of Interior Alaska's energy supply, and last year a study was commissioned that showed that without the coal in that electricity supply, Interior Alaska's power would cost $200 million more annually. So the Pogo Mine near Delta Junction is an underground gold mine. It's operated by Sumitomo, and it's entirely on State of Alaska land. Pogo employs 320 people and has a very promising future. Last year, Pogo spent $57 million on capital expenditures alone. So shifting to the community that we're all in right now, the Greens Creek Mine is one of the top 10 silver producers in the world, and it also produces gold, lead, and zinc. It's federally owned. In fact, it's located on a national monument and is operated by Hecla Mining Company. Greens Creek is the largest Southeast Alaska private employer in terms of payroll, and they employ 415 people. Also, as you know, the Kensington Gold Mine is an underground mine located in Lynn Canal. It's situated on State of Alaska federal and privately owned land, and it's operated by Coeur Mining. And Kensington is the second largest private employer in Southeast Alaska. They employ 320 people.
Madam Chair.
Excuse me, yes, Senator Stoltz.
I want to interrupt, but just this once, and that's folks often say the state is overly litigious, and I think there's a side story on Kensington that might be worth a minute or so to the story of the biggest challenge, not necessarily being economics or engineering, but legal challenges, and how long it took us to get to approval.
Sure. Senator Stoltz, through the chair, Kensington did actually have, and we have a timeline later on in this presentation of the most recent mines and how long it took. No, it's okay, but it is a great story because it did go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. There was litigation against its tailings facility that went all the way to the Supreme Court before being approved, and Kensington was allowed to go into operation. It's an interesting story of Kensington was in the position of having to lay off all the workers that were ready to go to work while that litigation went. And so to have that open and operating and benefiting this community today is a huge victory. Mm-hmm. So thank you for asking that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So back to the map you've seen before, only this time you'll see the exploration projects highlighted. The projects that are depicted by green triangles are the projects we consider to be in advanced exploration, meaning they're in the stages of determining their economic feasibility, or they expect to go into permitting soon, or are in permitting. And I'll briefly review those advanced projects, again, north to south. Upper Kobuk Mineral Projects is pursuing deposits of copper, zinc, gold, and silver on Nana Corporation land in the Ambler Mining District. Oh, thank you. Live and Good in Interior Alaska would produce gold. Placer gold mining occurred here for several decades until a lode source was discovered in the early 2000s. Feasibility studies have been conducted, and the company, Tower Hill Mines, is currently conducting project optimization. They estimate that they will employ 450 people at production. The Donlin Gold Project is an open pit mine design in the Yukon-Kuskokwim region. It's in its permitting process, which began in late 2012. In addition to the mine, the company is proposing to build a 315-mile natural gas pipeline from Cook Inlet to the mine site for its power plant. And the project's located on Chulista Native Corporation land and expects up to 1,400 employees at production. Wishbone Hill is a coal project being proposed by Usabelli, which operates the state's only coal mine, in the Sutton area of the Matanuska-Susitna Valley. The area is a historic coal mining district and was first mined in 1916. Wishbone Hill had its permits upheld last year, but is currently evaluating the project given market conditions for coal exports. Wishbone Hill has the potential to employ 75 to 125 people in the Mat-Su region. Chewitin is a coal project being proposed in West Cook Inlet near Tyonek. It's on a combination of state, mental health trust, private, and Kenai Peninsula borough lands. It's currently in permitting and expects draft permit decisions late this year or early next, and they estimate they'll have 300 to 350 production jobs. Most of you are aware of the Pebble Project. It's a copper, gold, and molybdenum deposit in southwest Alaska near Lake Iliamna. The project's located entirely on state of Alaska lands, and currently the project proponents are actively seeking an investment partner in addition to conducting the studies needed to be done at the site. Pebble estimates that they'll employ up to 1,000 people at production. Our last two are projects located on Prince of Wales Island. Nidlac is an underground copper, gold, zinc, and silver project. It's on state and federally owned land, and the status of that project is they are conducting the engineering and environmental studies needed to support a feasibility study. Nidlac estimates 200 employees at production. And the last is Bokan Mountain Dotson Ridge, which is a rare earth element deposit located entirely on federally owned land. And the project is also completing its studies to begin permitting. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Karen, where she'll tell you why mining passes the test.
Thank you, and I'd like to recognize that Representative Tarr has joined us as well. Thank you.
So there was a lot of information in the overview that Diantha just gave you. And one point that I'd like you to remember is that there are only six large producing mines in Alaska, five metal, one coal. It's not a lot. So I'd like to go over some of the questions that are asked about mining. Does it pay for itself? What are the environmental standards? And how does it benefit Alaskans? And I'll take each one of these in turn.
Karen, excuse me, I just want to recognize that Senator Welikowski has joined us. Welcome.
So, of course, companies pay their exploration, development, and construction costs. We're talking about modern mining here, which is technologically advanced, which adds to the costs. And Alaska is quite unique in the country in that often the deposits are in remote areas, so the companies are also looking at paying for access and infrastructure for the project. To give you a few examples, Red Dog and Kensington are completely off the grid, so they supply all of their own power. Greens Creek and Kensington built their own ports. Pogo built a 50-mile electrical transmission line and a road to the site. And Donlin, of course, is looking at a 315-mile natural gas pipeline. Some of these are mega projects in themselves. Then there's permitting. The state's costs for permitting are billed to the project. So to give you an example, Donlin's in permitting right now, and their reimbursable service agreement for this year with the state, not including any federal permitting, but with the state, it totals $900,000 for this year. There's also reimbursable service agreements for those mines that are already in operation because there's ongoing monitoring, there's normal regulation, and of course sometimes there's expansions that are being permitted. So another example is Red Dog. Their reimbursable service agreement with the state this year is $659,000. Then of course there's the financial assurance for reclamation and closure, which the companies put up at the beginning of the project. And I will go into that in more detail when I talk about some of the environmental aspects.
Excuse me, Karen. Senator Stoltz had a question.
I need to apologize. I made an appointment at 12:30, well before session started, not today's, but I mean January 20th. But I have a question about Chewitna, and the question is regarding the mental health trust, what their percentage of ownership is, or participation, however you can best define it, and are there any ideas of potential revenues? And I'd like to put on the record the trust responsibility and who the beneficiaries are. Folks with autism, Down syndrome, drug and alcohol abuse, Asperger's, a lot of things. Really the reason the KEY campaign was here, and I don't want to lose perspective that that's just not a, irrespective, it's become a poster child for advertising and so forth. But I think it's really important to recognize the beneficiaries of that and what a trust responsibility is. But what are the potentials of revenues for that, for the trust beneficiaries, the class of Alaskans, of whom many of them we saw last week during the Key campaign?
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, first of all, thank you for being here and for asking that important question. Mining is a big contributor to the trust, in which you're all aware we're given lands to develop in order to fund it moving forward. I know I have seen both the land ownership of how much acreage at Tuitna is on trust land versus the other borough and state land that it's on, as well as what they're projecting their revenues are, but I don't know them off the top of my head, so I'll make sure your office has that within a couple of days, if that's sufficient.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz.
Senator Geisel, to continue, one of the areas that we wanted to look at in terms of mining paying for itself is emphasizing the long timelines and how capital intensive it is to bring a project into production in Alaska. This list shows you the five metal mines in Alaska, and you'll see that two of them had the shortest amount of time between the deposit discovery and going into production, and that's 12 years. And two of the mines took more than two decades, one of which was Kensington because of the delays through litigation. And you'll see that that was 27 years from what we define as the first modern deposit discovery, because it was a historic district. And, of course, depending on the project, developing a mine into production, you could be looking at hundreds of millions of dollars. You could be looking at many billions of dollars. These are very large-scale projects. And it's understandable why companies need to have large market capitalization, access to financing, and plenty of patience if they're working to bring a large mine into production. The other thing I'd like to point out on this slide is the column, the second from the right, which is first production. The point I'd like to make here is that these five large mines, which represent the metal mining in Alaska, are young. The oldest, Red Dog and Greens Creek, started operations in 1989, so 26 years ago. And I'll be referring back to that number a little bit further, too, when we talk about some of the environmental standards and responsibilities. Now, you might say, well, wait, ADA has been involved in infrastructure investment. And let's look at DMTS, which is the DeLong Mountain Transportation System, which is the Red Dog Road and Port. ADA's total investment is $265 million. It has been fully recouped, and the payments, as currently scheduled, will continue to 2034. Keeping in mind that ADA's mission is economic growth and economic development for Alaska, I would say that the DMTS has been one of the best investments, if not the best investment, ADA has made to date. It helped Red Dog become an economic engine for the Northwest Arctic Borough, and it's also provided a steady and reasonable rate of return on that investment. So it's really the poster child for ADA being a driver for economic development in rural Alaska. ADA's also invested in the Skagway Ore Terminal, and whereas the size of that project is very different from Red Dog, if you think about Skagway, it's got a small population, its economy is very reliant on tourism, which is very seasonal. So those jobs at the port for the ore terminal are significant for Skagway's economy. And of course, mining's been involved in supporting infrastructure development in Alaska for over 100 years. Mining here in Juneau built the first hydroelectric dams, and some of them are still in use today, bringing clean, affordable energy to this very building. In Fairbanks, the Fort Knox mine provided an economy of scale for electrical generation that resulted in lower electrical rates for residential customers in Fairbanks. And then, of course, there's Donlin looking at a natural gas pipeline, which could be a real game changer for Western Alaska in terms of bringing cheaper and cleaner energy into that part of the state. I think it's unequivocal. Mining pays for itself in Alaska. So now I want to look at the environmental side of things. And I'll go over permitting, oversight, reclamation and closure, and the financial assurance that's required for that. But I want to make two points first. The first, as I mentioned before, the five metal mines in Alaska are very young. This is a modern industry. The five mines were permitted under modern environmental laws after the passage of NEPA and the Clean Water Act. As Lorna Shaw from the Pogo Mine likes to say, this is not your grandfather's mine. We have a 100-year history of mining in Alaska, but our metal mines are young, modern, and technologically advanced. The second point I want to make is that these mines were permitted in the 1980s, 90s, and the 2000s, when the general public and we as Alaskans demand high standards in terms of safety and environmental protection. We want responsible resource development, and that was the atmosphere under which they were permitted. So going on to permitting, this is a very busy slide, but that's kind of the point. And I know some of you have seen it before. The takeaway message here is that there's no one permit required to build a mine. Each project is different, and there are dozens of permits at the state, federal, and local level. In fact, Donlin estimates that they're looking at about 100 different permits and authorizations. And there's no guarantee. Submitting applications and going into the process is not a guarantee. The projects have to prove that they meet Alaska's tough standards. It's a multi-year process, and throughout, there's opportunities for public involvement, both to gain information about the projects, but also to provide comments and input for the record and for consideration. And of course, once a mine actually goes into operation, that strict regulatory oversight continues through the life of the mine. And we talked about the reimbursable service agreements. So during the operating period, the state's inspections to ensure that mines are complying with their permits, the cost of the state's regulatory side is billed to the industry, billed to the mine. So let's talk about reclamation and closure. When it comes time for a mine to close, Alaska law is very clear. The mine site must be returned to a stable condition. And in order to do that, long before the mine goes into operation, the reclamation plan must be approved by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. And the company must put up a financial assurance that's calculated by the regulators at third-party costs in order that if for some reason the company is unable to step up and undertake that reclamation and closure, the state has the resources to do so. And I want to make it very clear that that law and those requirements apply equally to U.S. companies and non-U.S. companies. The amount that's calculated as necessary at the beginning is not just set in stone and forgotten. It's reassessed every 5 years or whenever there's a significant change. So now Deantha is going to walk us through the economic benefits of mining in Alaska.
So you'll see on the slide above, and again, it's in that handout, the McDowell Group report that we do each year, Alaska's mining industry brings some pretty amazing economic benefits to our state. Some of the statistics are $620 million in annual payroll to Alaska's miners, $167 million in Alaska Native Corporation revenues, which under ANCSA, 70% of which are distributed to all regional and village corporations. $167 million in revenues to the state of Alaska and local communities, and I do need to put a caveat that that is a 2013 number. Generally, at this time each year, we do have 100% 2014 numbers, but we're told that the Department of Revenue has a new database to generate corporate income tax. So that number we're giving you is a 2013 number. $169 million was spent last year in exploration and development of future mining activity. $500 million spent on goods and services from Alaska businesses, $3 million in charitable donations and scholarships, and some of the most exciting, nearly 5,000 direct jobs, 8,700 total direct and indirect, that carry an average wage of $100,000 annually and employ residents of over 50 communities of our state. Half of those communities are in areas where there are a few other economic opportunities. In addition to jobs, local spending, donations to nonprofits, et cetera, mining provides very valuable and stable local government revenue. Mines are the top property taxpayers in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, Northwest Arctic Borough, again through the PILT system, and the City and Borough of Juneau. Mines also pay various forms of taxes to the Denali Borough and the City of Nome. And the Pogo Mine, which is not in an incorporated borough, makes a significant donation each year to Delta Junction and has established a community advisory board. So I'd like to take a moment and focus on placer mining in Alaska. First of all, what is placer mining? Placer mining takes place almost exclusively for gold, but on a much smaller scale than the large scale that we've already overviewed with you. They're much smaller scale in terms of operation size, employee count, and the major difference is that they separate their material, they don't use blasting or milling processes, and they don't use chemical to separate gold from the rock. Placer mining, this practice is becoming less and less common in this day and age, except that's absolutely untrue in our state. We have discussed for you, both AMA and CAP, for several years, the economic benefits of the six large mines and put out this brochure each year. All these great statistics on money spent in the state, royalties, et cetera, but we've never focused on or even researched the small-scale operations. So until this year, the real benefits of placer mining in Alaska was a question mark for us. You'll see inserted in that brochure that I keep referring to an overview on placer economics, and there is the full study on the table in the back of the room. And this is a study that AMA commissioned at the end of last year to see what the economic impact of placer mining in Alaska is. We surveyed more than 646 placer mine permit holders from 2013, and the results really gave us the big picture of what we were looking for. And we're pleased to say that we found, in addition to the six large operating mines, we really have a seventh large operating mine, and that's the combined placer mining industry. So as you can see on the slide, we've got around 300 actively mining operations that mine over 82,000 ounces of gold each year. And to tell you, there's a very strong link between the number of placer mines and the placer production and the price of gold. And to give you an example, in 2005, gold was approximately $450 an ounce. At that time, we had 71 active placer operations in the state. In 2011, it hit an all-time high of nearly $1,900 per ounce, and we ended up with 321 placer mines in the state. So here's where some of our most staggering numbers come in. In 2013, there were approximately 1,200 jobs in Alaska's placer mining industry. On average, each mine had four workers, but 27% of them only had one, a single one-man band. And we do have a few significant larger operations that are still placer mining operations, but they have 50 or over people. Of the 1,200 workers, 73% of them are Alaska residents. The total placer mining-related employment impact is 450 jobs in Fairbanks, 370 in the Anchorage and Mat-Su region, and 600 outside of those two. So well over half of our placer mining jobs are outside our major population centers. The total direct income, which includes wages, shares of production, and owners' profits, are estimated at $40 million for 2013. And interestingly, to me at least, nearly half of our active placer operations have that have employees have at least one family member working there. So we've got these bumper stickers you've seen before that say mining is the family farm of the North, and that's what we're trying to establish. So on the procurement level, placer miners spent approximately $65 million on goods and services in 2013, and 88% of that was spent in Alaska. Fairbanks had the highest impact at $32 million, followed by Anchorage at $16 million. And the remaining $8.5 million was spent in elsewhere in the state, much of which supported small rural economies. In addition, placer mining pays state revenues, royalties, claim rentals, taxes, etc. The last slide on placer mining operations is about reclamation. Just like large-scale mines, placer mines, their permits require them to restore the land to previous or better condition. So here on the slide, you'll see an area that was mined in the after photo taken just 9 years later. Reclamation techniques in Alaska generally aren't a one-size-fits-all standard for placer mining. And the vast majority in our cases in the AMA membership, the miners have been there for several decades. So they know their land very well. They know how to bring the vegetation and the critical habitat back at the best. And our placer miners, we're really proud to say, many of them have been honored by BLM and DNR for their reclamation efforts. That's something to be proud of.
So we've talked about how mining pays for itself, covering its exploration and development costs, as well as permitting, contributing to infrastructure. We've looked at the environmental regulations, the high standards that Alaska has, the requirement that the companies provide financial assurance for reclamation and closure. Deantha's just gone through the economic benefits, the 8,700 jobs in mining, direct and indirect, and the average salary of $100,000 a year. I'd like to add one more point, which I think mining really contributes to economic diversity, which is so important for Alaska's prosperity. So with all this good news, why isn't there more mining in Alaska? Part of the answer to that question is permitting uncertainty. On the state level, we are very confident in the rigor and strength of the permitting agencies. We think that it's very important that they be funded to be able to do their job thoroughly and efficiently. The problem more is with uncertainty is on the federal side, and you know that EPA last year started a process that could preemptively veto the Pebble project before it submits an application to be reviewed under the NEPA process. And this would be the first time this is done in the history of the Clean Water Act. So it worries not just mining in Alaska, but it worries people all over the country because it's unprecedented and it involves more than just the mining industry. But it's not just about Pebble. These permitting delays impact other companies in the industry as well. And an example is Greens Creek, just here in the Juneau area. As I mentioned, Greens Creek started operations in 1989. And so not long ago, they needed to expand their existing tailings storage facility. What ultimately was approved as an 18-acre expansion of an existing facility took 5 years for permitting. But there's another part of the equation as well, and that's the economic realities that we're facing right now. Just about everybody in Alaska knows that the price of oil has gone down in the last few months significantly. But people don't follow metal prices quite as closely, and a lot of people are unaware the decline that's been continuing in metal prices really since the highs of 2011, so over the past 3.5 years. To give you an example of what that means globally, the S&P Global Mining Index between January 2011 and January 2015 dropped 50%. I looked at five large mining companies, global mining companies that are active in Alaska, and I charted their share price in that same period from January 2011 to last month, and found that on average, their share prices dropped 75% during that period. And so what that means, of course, is that they have less ability to make big investments. Where we also really see the impact of lower metal prices is in exploration spending. So very, very simply, generally the companies that develop and operate large mines are called the majors, and companies that go out looking for that next big deposit, do the exploration, are referred to as the juniors. And the juniors tend to cover the costs of their operations by raising money predominantly on the Canadian Stock Exchange. Investors right now, they're scared off by lower metal prices, but they're also looking at other options. Since the economic recovery since 2009, there are non-mining investments that people are looking at. So there are fewer dollars for the junior exploration companies to attract. And we've seen this globally. Exploration spending globally was cut in half between 2012 and 2014. But we really see it in Alaska. We had a record high in 2011 of $365 million. And this is money that's raised in Canada and spent in Alaska. It's spent on exploration drilling, on helicopters and transportation, on remote camp services. Last summer, because exploration takes place mostly in the summer, The amount that was spent on exploration in Alaska was $67 million, so a huge drop from those numbers in 2011.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Josephson.
Ms. Mathias, could you just repeat the first number in 2011?
Yes. Representative Josephson, through the chair, according to AMA's McDowell report, in 2011, exploration spending in Alaska was $365 million.
Senator Welikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you give me the basic understanding of why metal prices have gone down? It would seem to me intuitively that the economy is doing well. I understand why oil has gone down because there's a glut of oil, but it seems with the economy going well, there would be more of a need for precious, for these metals.
Senator Welikowski, through the chair, one of the mining experts in my group says, whenever you're asked a question about prices, the answer is China. The short answer. But it's hard to underestimate the impact that China has on the base metal prices. In the 1980s, the amount of base metals that China was consuming was a pretty small percentage, and I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but it's now a much higher percentage, and I'm just going to quickly see. So 45% of zinc in the world is bought by China. And as you know, China's economic growth has slowed over the last couple of years. So that has a major impact on prices. There's also a lot of very complicated issues regarding stockpiling and hedging and futures, and I don't have the expertise to go into that, but it plays into those prices. So another area where we see the impact, metal prices going down, exploration spending going down, the one thing that we see going up is operating costs. This chart looks at difference in prices between in a 10-year span between 2003 and 2013. So you see salaries going up, you see equipment almost doubling in that 10-year period, and of course the price of diesel in that 10-year period tripled. So you might say, well, fuel prices are a lot lower right now. Well, that's true if you live in South Central, and you know it's relatively true here in Juneau. It's not true in rural Alaska. And when you think of an example like Red Dog, which is entirely off the grid and remote, they have to bring in a year's supply of fuel to power the entire operation during the period that the port is ice-free. So they brought in about 20 million gallons of diesel at the end of the summer last year, and they paid July 2014 prices for that diesel. So this entire year of activity, they're paying some of the highest diesel prices around. They'll only see relief on their diesel prices if the prices are low next July. They've got sort of a one shot on that. Another area where we see the decline in exploration spending having a real impact is in communities in Alaska where we have employees of mining companies living. In 2012, this is a map from the McDowell report, the little orange dots that are a bit hard to see on this screen represent over 120 communities in Alaska where at least one mining employee lived. And that's one of the things that we've been most proud to talk about is the regional impact and the rural impact of mining in Alaska. You remember those jobs, average salary is $100,000 a year. It's twice the average salary of the state. And you see those dots all over the state. Yet 2 years later, we have fewer communities where mining employees live. And that's directly connected to less exploration activity. The good news is that the overall jobs numbers in mining haven't gone down that much, but that's because the producing metal mines have added jobs. And so that's something that is important to consider. Although prices have declined and operational costs have gone higher, those five producing metal mines are employing people at good salaries. They are contributing to local and state government. They're making payments to Alaska Native Corporation. They're buying local goods and services, and all while maintaining the strictest standards on environmental and safety. So ultimately, we want to see more exploration, more development, more production, so mining can make an even greater contribution to Alaska. And I'm going to turn it back over to Deanth to finish.
So I get the fortunate task of telling you that it's not all gloom and doom. We absolutely believe that the single largest factor that will continue to draw investment to Alaska is our potential. The potential for increased activity on the mining scale in the state, both discovered and undiscovered, has given us an excellent reputation. It's said across different resource sectors that we work with that Alaska has really great rocks. It's absolutely true. We do have world-class deposits in Alaska that, despite some formidable challenges economically and politically, are worthy of pursuit and will bring new investment and more jobs and countless other benefits to Alaska. In addition to that, we firmly believe the mining industry has tremendous support, not only from the state of Alaska lawmakers. We actually have the statistics to prove that mining has a very good reputation and support from the general public in Alaska. So to recap, we believe that mining not only passes the test, but will continue to work for Alaska. The six large producing mines and hundreds of placer mines in our state have bright futures and future projects that bring the promise of an increasingly diversified economy. We have excellent environmental and safety records, and we're proud of them, and we intend to build on those successes moving forward. We've proven to be a significant contributor to the economy, and again, our mineral resources are significant and impressive on a global scale, which will put us in the spotlight for increased mining and subsequently increased economic benefit for the state. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Deantha and Karen. Senator Wielichowski had a question.
Thank you. Thank you. Good presentation. Can you talk a little bit about where we're headed in the near future in terms of rare earth minerals?
Sure. Senator Wielichowski, through the chair, as I outlined in the advanced exploration segment, we do have one project down on Prince of Wales Island that is a rare earth deposit. And what is said to be special about that, I was given a crash course in rare earth elements, and there are heavy rare earths and there are light rare earths. So there's a segment of rare earths that are rarer than rare, apparently, and those are the heavy. And there are a fraction of those is what being pursued at the Bokan Mountain project. So where we stand right now is with that, and there are some other deposits of rare earths in the state that aren't being actively pursued at this time, is that Alaska stands to be the sole domestic supplier of rare earths to the United States. Right now, almost entirely, 100% of it is being imported from, guess, China. And so our future there is that we would be the one domestic supplier in the United States should Bokan Mountain, Dotson Ridge move forward.
Very good. Further questions from committee members? Yes, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, thinking about the Pebble Mine and comparing in comparison to the Mount Polly disaster, and my understanding is the tailings pond design is somewhat similar, and going back to the reclamation piece of this, and I was just checking some facts here, you know, the estimated is at least $500 million in reclamation costs, but they only had $14.5 million in their bonds for that type of work. So can you talk a little bit about the relationship between those two numbers and how that could be applied to Alaska?
When it comes to Mount Polly, I want to start by saying it was unacceptable and should never have happened. The track record of the mines in Alaska that have tailing storage facilities is excellent, and we are very confident that the state of Alaska has a very robust regulatory system and a dam safety officer whose responsibility is oversight of design and construction and monitoring of the tailing storage facilities in Alaska. Pebble has not submitted an application, so we don't know exactly what Pebble's operation would look like, and it's very premature to assess their tailing storage facility options when we lack the information at this point. So that's something that will remain to be seen, and I can assure you that the company will be looking at the best available technologies in order to put forward that application.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Giesel had to leave, so we've gone from a real starter to a bench warmer now. But are there any other questions or comments? Senator Costello.
Thank you, and I appreciate you coming here to present an update on the mining industry in our state. And my question has to do with the taxes on the mining industry and how we compare with other jurisdictions in the world, and are we competitive?
Senator Costello, through the chair, we have provided you with a handout, the one that says Mining Works for Alaska, and if you turn just past midway, I'm sorry, there isn't a page number on it.
We gave you a lot of stuff, this one.
There's a lot of information presented there that goes into the details of mining taxation in Alaska. It's been a little while, but some years ago, the state of Alaska hired an international consultant to look at mining taxation in Alaska, Dr. James Otto, and he determined that when you take the full measure of the mining taxes that are paid in Alaska, the corporate state income tax that all businesses pay, plus the Alaska mining license tax, the other royalties and rent payments that are from the mines that are on state land, and keep in mind that rents and royalties really depend on land ownership. So we only have one mine that exclusively operates on state land. The mine, like Red Dog, is on Native Corporation land, private land. So the royalty goes to the Native Corporation, and of course through ANCSA revenue sharing provisions, it actually goes out to all of the regional and village corporations. But any mine that's on state land pays the rent and royalty to the state. So he looked at that full measure, and he looked at exploration credits and factored it in, and he found that Alaska came at about the middle of the pack at that time in terms of competitiveness with mining jurisdictions from the rest of the world.
Senator Costello, please.
Thank you. And we've certainly heard of the success of the OPUMP program within the Department of Natural Resources that the companies pay for through, you know, themselves. But do we see any improvement in the near future in terms of the permitting process becoming less timely?
Senator Costello, through the chair, that's kind of a two-pronged answer, if I may. On the state level of permitting, OPUMP, and I'm glad you brought that up, is wonderful. It provides the permit coordination among both state and federal agencies. That the other prong of my answer on the federal level that generally there are a lot of struggles with currently, our employees at OPUMP are engaged with the federal agencies that our projects need permits from as well. So on the state side, I'm sure there's always room for improvement, but we certainly are very happy with both the timeliness as well as the rigor of the system and the standards that we have to meet. On the federal side, there's just our biggest issue there is both uncertainty and the delay in receiving them, and we're hopeful. Do you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chair, of course, what I meant was less time intensive, not less timely, so thank you for that. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just on this comment, the previous comments about the federal side taking too long, can you give some specific examples of where there have been delays that you're problematic, excluding Pebble Mine?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, the most recent example that I gave is Greens Creek and the expansion of an existing tailing storage facility that took 5 years. Mm-hmm. And ultimately what was approved was an 18-acre expansion. Mm-hmm. That is a considerable amount of time for a permit of an existing facility to be expanded.
Follow up?
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on that one, could you just talk about how the end result was different from the initial application to understand why it might have taken 5 years?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, if I may, I have a representative here from Greens Creek who would be far better capable of getting into answering that question. So I'd like to ask Mike Satry if he would come to the
microphone.
I would just be illustrative for my understanding.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Mike Satry. I'm with Hecla Greens Creek Mine here in Juneau. And Representative Tarr, through the chair, would be happy to answer questions on our permitting process. We initiated a NEPA process, full EIS, for an expansion of our tailings facility in late 2009. We asked for approximately 150 acres of tailings expansion to support the full potential or possibly even more than we have potential for the mine. We wanted to ask for everything we possibly could at one time and then open that up incrementally so we could look at the cumulative impacts of ongoing development in the area. At the time we started the process, it was estimated to be approximately 2 years on the federal side, and then there would, of course, be some permits that followed that. We ran into delays during development of the draft EIS process, significant delays, which ultimately led to a delayed issuance of the Record of Decision. And because of the change in the Record of Decision that allowed us the very small expansion relative to the original ask, then there were delays in the 404 permitting process because the project itself had changed, and we had to take a look at different things and how we were dealing with mitigation on the wetlands. So, you know, our hope was to look at, you know, and really with all the stakeholders, both on Admiralty Island and Juneau, to take a good hard look at the long-term cumulative impacts of establishing a tailings facility out the mine. Unfortunately, we have one that will now just barely support our 10-year mine life, a little bit over that, and we're going to have to start another full NEPA process here probably in the next 2 years.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the committee members? Well, thank you very much today for this presentation. I'd like to reference your reclamation enclosure slide just to let you know that you nearly caught my house in there in the background on the Indiana River.
So I want to go back and look.
I nearly got homesick when I saw that.
Right there on the right, yeah.
That's very nice. And one other thing, I'd really like to thank you, Karen, for doing a safety share. I was involved in safety in this industry at one point in time, and that has turned into a regular routine, I know, which I think you mentioned, and how important that can be. My former employer had a calendar year where it was safer to work there than it was all of the retail outlets in the North Star Borough for a calendar year. And for that type of industry, those are amazing accomplishments. I know the safety records are really good, so thank you for that. And I would recommend to anyone in any industry, it's a good idea to start your day with a safety share. So we really appreciate you being here today, and thank you so much for the presentation.
Thank you.
And thank you for the committee members that were able to come and go through the presentation. And with that, we will close this meeting at 1:05. We are adjourned.